and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, this 14th of August, 2011. Today we're going to be talking about one of the great important issues of our times, which is the growth of economic inequality in the United States. We're going to have two authorities who have a new book out on the subject, two of the finest political scientists in the country, with their new book, Winner Take All Politics. We'll be discussing the reasons we have inequality as well as its effects. It should be an extraordinary hour. I hope you'll join us. But before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Many small towns dotting the Berkshire Hills of western Massachusetts have been waiting for high-speed broadband for years. But Verizon and AT&T don't bother building out to tiny hamlets with sparse populations. So 47 towns took matters into their own hands and began working together on a plan to bring state-of-the-art fiber-optic broadband to their area. In February 2010, they launched the Wired West Initiative.
All of our groups realized we really were not making significant progress, all of us working in silos, that to come together, we would legitimately have the basis to form our own last-mile municipal broadband network.
Monica Webb is co-chair of the steering committee that helped bring the effort together.
It was clear that the enthusiasm and the interest to do this on a regional basis, to really solve this problem in a way that would serve our interests, was there.
Each town held a vote to join the initiative. The group consulted experts around the country, developed a detailed business plan, and sought out financing. The research uncovered an old Massachusetts law created in 1906 to help communities create their own electric systems, the Municipal Light Plant legislation.
The Municipal Light Plant legislation was created to enable towns to build and operate their own electric infrastructure. In the 1950s, community television was added to the statute, and in the mid-1990s, the ability to offer telecommunication services was added.
It's also a way to protect community broadband networks from large internet service providers like Verizon, AT&T, and Time Warner, who have successfully thwarted community broadband in several states. Webb says these community networks are the only way to bring broadband to areas that corporate providers ignore.
The reason Wired West exists is because there isn't enough profit margin for a private provider to provide universal coverage with high-quality service. However, when you look at a municipal model, you take the profit margin requirement out, and you look at the fact that you can borrow money at low cost and pay it back over a much longer period of time, and suddenly it's feasible.
23 towns have established the plants after winning two separate supermajority elections required by the statute. On August 13th, they'll be incorporating as the Wired West Communications Cooperative. Other towns can join the cooperative when they complete the light plant process. Webb hopes to be up and running in the fall of 2013. Check out Wired West at wiredwest.net.
Environmentalists have long complained that their concerns are rarely given attention in the traditional news media, and their complaints seem justified, since only catastrophes like oil spills and chemical leaks get covered, while ongoing campaigns to protect the environment are routinely ignored. But a new online news site in Michigan is trying to keep the public current on one topic, rivers. The site is called Michigan River News, and is producing original reporting about the 36,000 miles of rivers crisscrossing the state. Jeff Gillies and Andrew McGlashan created the project after graduating from Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. Why rivers? Gilly says he's been captivated by them.
For me, it started with a college class in aquatic biology when the labs were basically, 10 or 12 students piling in a van with a bunch of pairs of waders, jumping in and with nets and just finding out what was there. And there's an incredible diverse life going on in rivers.
As rivers wind around bends and disappear into the horizon, Gilly says it's difficult for people to understand how the waterways connect communities and how it impacts and reflects the health of these communities.
Also with rivers, it's not just what's upstream and what's downstream. It's not just what's right on the banks. The river is only as healthy as the hundreds and thousands of acres of land that it flows through, those cities and those farms, everything that drains into it.
Gillies and McGlashan also created the site because traditional media didn't offer them the opportunity to report on issues they care about.
Well, journalism jobs might be available, becoming more scarce, but they're still available. Environmental journalism jobs are a fraction of that. Even if we could get journalism jobs, we'd be covering courts or crime. And that's important news, but that wasn't really what we wanted to do.
Gilly says their goal is to become a trusted and authoritative source of information, both for river enthusiasts and for the larger public. To visit the site, go to MichiganRiverNews.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580, coming to you live this Sunday from the Heartland. Our guests today are the co-authors of a brand new book, or a relatively brand new book, Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. The author is Jacob Hacker, is a professor of political science at Yale. The co-author with him, Paul Pearson, is also a professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley. And I want to thank both of them for joining me today. Jacob, Paul?
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Bob.
Well, I wrote you both letters after reading your book this summer in research for something I'm working on. And, I hold this book in the highest esteem. I've recommended it to a number of friends who've shared my enthusiasm for it. So it's an honor, really, to have you on the program. And, I think I'd like to start with some basics because we have a lay audience. And just Jacob, if you could just start by laying out what has happened to economic inequality over the past three decades in the United States. I think a lot of people sense something has happened, but if you could put some numbers on it and some frame of reference for people to understand the dimensions of it.
Well, I think most people recognize there has been this shift, that the gap between those at the top and the rest of Americans has grown. But what we were struck by as we started to really investigate this transformation is just how top-heavy that change has been, how much of it has really consisted of the very, very richest pulling away from the rest of Americans. And just to give you a sense of that, we have now evidence based on tax statistics going back to before the Great Depression, back to the origins of the tax code. And in 2007, the top 1% of Americans had around 24%, earned about 24% of national income. That was the highest level that we've seen at any point since before the Great Depression, and it's really the top 0.1% that has gotten the lion's share of those gains. These folks have seen their share of income increase more than fourfold, quadruple, over the last 30 years or so. So that's the first point that we really wanted to drive home in the book, is that inequality in the United States is winner-take-all. It's really been the very, very richest corporate executives and financial executives in particular who've pulled away from middle-class Americans and even upper-middle-class Americans. It's not the poor falling away from the rest of us.
And now the argument by those who don't really mind the developments in the economy in the last three decades is that a rising tide raises all the boats and that everyone else comes along behind them. Paul Pearson, has that been the case in the last three decades?
Well, no, it clearly hasn't, as you can get a sense from those numbers that Jacob mentioned. We draw a contrast between the way the economy worked in the period after World War II, the three decades after World War II, and we call that version of the United States Broadland, and it operated the way that you just described, Bob. It wasn't a country that was becoming dramatically more equal, but But everybody was going up together. Everybody's incomes were growing at basically the same rate. So rising tide lifts all boats was a fair way to describe it. But since the late 1970s, we've been on this transit to Richistan. And the image we use to describe that is, you know, imagine a canal with locks and for different parts of the canal where basically 99% of the population, or 90% of it anyway, has been stuck behind one set of locks, while the part that is actually going up is limited just to people at the top. So it's really astonishing. Over that almost 30-year period, close to half of all the income growth that's taken place in the United States has gone to the top 1% of the population.
One of the things you do, Professor Pearson, in the book is that you say, what would have happened to income distribution had we kept the same pattern from 1945 to 1973, if we kept that from 1979 to today? And what would our income distribution look like today? What would it look like for the, you know, bottom 60% of the population if we had stayed in the old system of income distribution?
Well, the numbers, the numbers would look a lot better for those at the bottom. It's why we think that this is a big part of the story of what's happened to the middle class in the U.S. over the last 30 years. So, you know, if median income in the U.S., Jacob probably knows these figures better than I do, but if median income for a household in the U.S. is $45,000 or $50,000, it might look more like $60,000 if you hadn't seeing this shift in income distribution.
There's one graph in the book, and the book is filled with extraordinary data and charts to help those of us who like visual representation. But one chart in particular, all my friends and colleagues who've read it have commented on this chart to me. It's on page 23, where you highlight the income growth for the wealthiest 1% versus other groups. And to fit the massive increase to the top 1%, the other gains or differences are almost microscopic on the page because you can barely get it on a printed page via a coherent graph.
Yeah, if people have seen An Inconvenient Truth, where Al Gore tries to describe what's happened to carbon levels in the atmosphere when they have to put him on a lift in the auditorium to get him up to where the graph is going.
Yeah.
If we could have had some way to visualize that in a book, we would have needed something like that.
Well, Jacob Hacker, the book obviously is about politics, and we're going to get the heart of the show. I want to talk about the politics, but just even before we get into the details of how this came about and what the conventional wisdom has been and your argument, economic inequality sounds abstract and esoteric, but, I mean, it really is at the core of democratic political theory, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, we have a whole chapter which we entitle A Brief History of American Democracy. And in that chapter, we really look at the great theorists of democracy, and all of them were deeply concerned about these kinds of differences. This was the vision of for example, James Madison, who was concerned about the mischief of faction. While the founders of the nation who wrote the Constitution were not, you know, radical egalitarians, they were very worried that that very large differences of property and income would spill over and influence politics. And they believed strongly that the basic idea of democracy was that all men, at that time all white men, were created equal. And so there's a real puzzle that is raised by what's happened. In some ways, it's the mystery that drives the whole book, is that in democracy, you do not get votes based on how much income or wealth you have. You're supposed to be able to have equal influence on what government does. And given the trends that we're talking about, a really tiny slice of the population has benefited dramatically, while the rest of Americans have seen not just relatively slow growth, but really quite substantial declines in their economic security, increases in a lot of the pressures that they're facing in their everyday and work lives, and there's not been an increase over this period in upward social mobility that has allowed people to climb into those top reaches. So we've seen a trend that just looks very puzzling from the standpoint of these great thinkers who said, you know, one of the things that democracy will do is make it so that ordinary people who don't have substantial income or wealth have the ability to shape what government does.
I'm Bob McChesson, and you're listening to Media Matters, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. Our guest, the co-authors of the new book, Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, published by Simon & Schuster, Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson, joining us from New Haven and Berkeley, California. They're respectively professors of political science at Yale and UC Berkeley. The phone number, if you'd like to call in with the questions for Professors Hacker and Pearson, is 217-333-9455. That's our local line. And our toll-free line, of course, 1-800-222-9455. Now, what you do in the book, professors, that I think we should turn to now is you take the conventional wisdom for why this growth of inequality is taking place. And in many ways, it's an apologia as much as a conventional wisdom. And you sort of debunk it and then provide an alternative. Let's start with that conventional wisdom, Professor Pearson. Something called skill-based technological change is held up as the reason why we've had this growth of inequality. Can you explain what that is and why that's not convincing to you?
And so the economists have this this technical term, but the basic logic behind it is pretty familiar, I would think, for most of your listeners, that it's supposed to be a story of technology and globalization, right? That the economy has changed as a result of innovations, especially innovations in information technology. The world's been knitted more closely together. The U.S. is exposed to those pressures, and it's changed the way that the economy distributes its rewards, and particularly it's changed them in a way that rewards the educated and the skilled at the expense of the uneducated and unskilled. And you will hear this argument continues to be made even after the recent economic crisis over and over again. It has been sort of the standard conventional wisdom of economists and of many policymakers. And we saw basically two big problems with this. And we're not saying that these things don't matter. They clearly do matter, but we were not at all convinced that it was the full story. And there are two reasons why we were skeptical. One is because this seems like a story that would favor the educated over the uneducated, but as Jacob was describing earlier, the gains to the economy are much, much more concentrated than you would expect given that story. It's not, you know, the 25% of Americans who have college degrees or the almost 10% of Americans who have postgraduate degrees who are the winners from this new economic system. It's really the top 1% and especially the top 10th of 1% or top 100th of 1%. So that immediately raises a puzzle because many highly skilled, highly educated people are on the losing side of this transformation, which suggests that something else is going on. And then the second thing that made us skeptical of this is that if you look at other wealthy nations, many of which have levels of productivity comparable to the U.S., are exposed to globalization to the same extent or even more than the United States is, technologically advanced, these countries have not seen the same kind of hyper-concentration of income that's been experienced in the U.S. So that, again, if it's just technology and globalization, you would expect to see a common pattern across the world of affluent nations, and you do not see that.
Professor Hacker, where should we look then to get a better explanation for why we see such extraordinarily widening economic inequality in the United States over the last three decades?
Well, we really argue you have to look back home. You have to see how these broader transformations have really been, their effects have really been shaped by what government has done and not done, and then ultimately by our politics and the way American politics has transformed over the last generation. I think there is a great deal of skepticism about the idea that government could play a big role in shaping these trends. I mean, we think about programs like Social Security and Medicare and maybe programs that are helping those at the bottom, and we know that those programs do change the distribution of income, but how could they explain the stark transformation that we've seen where the very rich have pulled away from the rest? And we find by really looking deeply into what government does that there's just a huge range of areas where government has not just stood on the sidelines but actively promoted this hyper-concentration of income. And I'll just name two because...
Yeah, please take your time. This is very important.
Yeah, because they're so crucial. The first is financial deregulation and what's happened in the financial markets. And, you know, after the great collapse of the markets, and it seems like we're living through another one today, but after the collapse back in 2007, 2008, it became clear that these gains that had occurred at the very, very top among financial executives and the like had huge spillover effects, negative spillover effects on the rest of us. And we're now just coming to grips with the extent to which they reflected a active policy of deregulation that allowed those at the top in these firms to make huge sums while putting the rest of the economy at risk. And there's some very good work by economists and political economists that has shown that, that not only did this transformation in policy have real risks for our financial system and its stability, but also led to very high rates of income within the sector, much higher in the financial sector than in any other sector for similarly skilled workers. And then the second transformation that we talk about that, again, has not received the kind of attention it's due is really how our tax code has changed for the very rich. And we're beginning to hear a little bit about this as we talk about the extension of the Bush tax cuts for the richest. I mean, one of the things that people don't recognize is that while tax rates have come down for across the board, they've come down very, very sharply on the richest. In fact, the average tax rate, when you include all federal taxes that's paid by, say, the top 1% or the top 0.1%, has dramatically declined. And it's really within the top 1%, the top 1/10th of 1%, the top 1/100th of 1%, where you see the steepest declines. So we used to have a tax code that actually was very progressive, that is, charging higher rates to higher incomes in the very top. And today we don't. Someone making a few $100,000 a year may pay the same tax rate as someone making millions and tens of millions and even billions of dollars a year. And it's gotten to the point where Warren Buffett recently said that he thought he was paying a lower tax rate than the people who worked for him. And we were struck by just how concentrated these tax cut gains were for the very top. We describe in the book these changes as economic smart bombs in the sense that they're so narrowly targeted and they're welcomed by their beneficiaries. These smart bombs are not delivering payloads of TNT. They're delivering payloads of cash to their carefully selected recipients. So just those two changes give you a sense of the policy shifts that we trace. And you see this in corporate governance policy with executive compensation and in other areas. But those two areas really sort of show you the extent to which government has actually played a very important role in promoting this winner-take-all economy.
You just been listening to Jacob Hacker. He is our guest today, along with his co-author, Paul Pearson. They're the authors of Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, just published by Simon & Schuster. The phone number here at WILL for Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now to line one. Champaign County, you're on the air with Hacker and Pearson.
Hi, thank you. I'm in the horns of a cognitive dissonance here. I was going to argue that, you know, Americans know this. The polls have shown that people want a progressive tax. They want the rich to pay more. I think if there was discussion of it in the media, they would accept things like a transaction tax, slow down the rate of finance capitalism, and gain some of that wealth. I think they would even go so far as accepting maybe a one-time levy, a wealth tax. But there seems to be such a disconnect between the politics where people can get up and say, no tax is good, all we have to do is get rid of it. But then I was also thinking the other side of my dissonance is that a lot of people don't have a misapprehension of what's actually going on. And I don't know if the discussion was here or whether you're familiar with it, but there was a Pew poll that polled both laymen and economists and asked them to look at a income distribution and whether they thought it was reasonable or not. And turns out it was the income distribution of Sweden. And even the right-wing economists thought, well, that's probably pretty good, and the U.S. probably isn't far from this. Well, you know, it is very far from that. And even economists didn't understand the level of poverty in this country. and avoidance or denial or something. So I don't know if you understand my dilemma. I'm arguing that Americans know this, that it's a raw deal, et cetera, et cetera. There's no way to seemingly get actual discussion in any of the horse race politics that's going on. And at the same time, there's an incredible misapprehension of how bad things are and how bad the income distribution is. So I was just, not a question, but I just wanted you to, are you familiar with, for once, the survey I was talking about that was done about income distribution and what the misapprehension that existed in both laymen and economists?
Well, yes. Thank you very much, Champaign County. I must say, for the sake of our listeners, he covered basically the rest of the book in one form or another in that question. It touched on so many important points. So, Paul Pearson, maybe just answer directly if you're about the survey you talked about. And then if you would go to the first point he made, which I think was the next thing I wanted to ask you about, was the contrast between the will of the people in this country and all the polling and the actual performance of the political system, this massive disconnect between what the government's doing and what the people of the country apparently wanted to do with regard to inequality.
Right. So the speaker's point, the caller's point, is very well taken. And just the quick answer to his cognitive dissonance, I would say, is that both the things that he said are true. And that it is the case that the public tends to considerably underestimate how unequal the income distribution has become, and especially just how top heavy it is. And we talk about this at some length in the book, that most Americans would be startled to see the actual numbers. But even though they underestimate inequality, it is also the case that people strongly favor a more progressive tax structure. And indeed, there are very, very few things that if you ask voters that they say that they would be willing to support to reduce the deficit. But at the top of their list of things that they would like to see happen to reduce the deficit would be to increase taxes on the highest income groups. So obviously there's a disconnect between that and what's going on in Washington. And as you're saying, Bob, core to our book is to try to work through that puzzle. If it's the case that the income distribution is becoming much, much more unequal, moving towards these winner-take-all outcomes, and if it's the case that government policy is playing a critical role in that, and I think there's more to be said on that topic than we've had time to talk about so far, how did that happen? How does that happen in a democracy? And that's really the central puzzle in the book is to explore what's happened over the last 30 years. We call it a 30-year war in which Washington has weighed in more and more on behalf of those at the top rather than the broad mass of Americans. That's really the central puzzle that we try to tackle in the book. And maybe I'll just say to start that conversation off, that we think that most analysts of American politics make a fundamental mistake by focusing almost entirely on elections and on the connection between voters and politicians, whereas we think that what's happened in Washington is more often driven by powerful organized interests who are focusing on getting whichever politicians are there to do the things that they favor and hammer away at that day after day. So central to our book is a plea for people to pay less attention to what we call the politics of electoral spectacle and more attention to the politics of organized combat.
Jacob Hacker, one of the striking bits of research in your book that's been done by a series of political scientists in recent years was about the, to put it baldly, the complete lack of influence the great bulk of voters have over their elected representatives and the extraordinary influence a small percentage of affluent and very wealthy voters have over their representatives by comparison. And it was astonishing for me to read that, and believe me, it takes a lot to astonish me about those sort of things.
Yeah, these are very striking findings, and they go back to that, that point I made when I was talking about the development of American democracy, that we would think in a democracy that, that ordinary voters have a lot of sway because they, after all, have just as many votes as those at the top, And it's just an important ideal of our democracy that we're all equal politically in our ability to influence what government does. We know that's not true. We know that there are differences in participation and sophistication about politics. But these new studies that you mentioned really drive home the extent to which there's a real disconnect between the opinions, demands of middle-income and less affluent voters on the one hand and politicians on the other. So the two studies that we cite are by scholars who were at Princeton at the time they did their work, and that one is looking at the correspondence between constituents' views and the views of senators, and the other is looking at whether policy changes occur at all when people in the electorate support them. And both of them find that basically when there is a divergence of opinion between the high-income group, segment of the population and middle-income people or poor people, it's really the high-income people that seem to have influence over their representatives. Now, we don't know why that is, and I would just point out one thing that I think is really important here is that this is really only the tip of the iceberg of what Paul and I are exploring in the book, because as Paul was saying, we think that what's probably driving a lot of this disconnect is the pressure of organized groups that are involved in Washington debates, and often in debates that most of the public knows very little about. How many people are following the implementation of the financial reform bill? I can tell you the Financial Services Roundtable and other Wall Street lobbies are following it very closely. So in some ways, right, that on issues where people actually probably know something and where, you know, there are public opinion polls taken, that we see this disconnect, and that it's a disconnect that's between, say, the top 10% or 20% of the population and the rest of voters, that's just the tip of the iceberg, because in winner-take-all politics, we show that it's really an even smaller slice at the top that's really gaining from a lot of these decisions, and there's this huge network of organized groups that are pushing very hard for those policy changes. So I want to just go back to a point I was making before about
how
government has really played an important role in this, and just say that I think that there are two big points that we try to make in the book about how we should understand American politics and how we often don't understand American politics. And one is the point that Paul made, that really we need to pay attention to organized interest groups as well as voters. We need to pay attention to the sort of day-to-day policy and governing debates as well as elections. But the other point that we make when we talk about what government has done that I think is absolutely crucial is that we need to look beyond just, you know, when government passes a big law, what effect does it have? We have to also think about the way in which all these laws shape the way our economic markets work. And so deregulation is a great example. It's not just that there was this deregulation after deregulation, but also that fundamentally reshaped the way the American economy worked, changed the relationship between corporations and workers. It changed the incentives that chief executives had. It changed the incentives that corporations had to lobby. Similarly, we have to pay attention to when government doesn't act, because over and over in the last generation, what we've seen is that there have been demands for action. There's been concern about trends like runaway executive pay or declining unions, but there hasn't been action. And it's been harder and harder because of the Senate filibuster, because of the growing polarization of the two parties. It's been harder and harder to get the government to act in a positive way. And that, we say, is a really important part of the political story that we often miss. So we really do need to look not just beyond elections, but look beyond just the passage of big new laws, because a lot of what is happening, a lot of what's creating this winner-take-all economy is really not in those big new laws, but in the failure of government to act and in the way in which government is often subtly reshaping the way the economy works.
That was Jacob Hacker, professor at Yale and co-author with my other guest, Paul Pearson, of the new book, Winner Take All Politics, published by Simon & Schuster. If you'd like to call in with a question, the lines are open at 333-9455 or our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Professor Pearson, let's get right to the heart of what I think is sort of the dynamic part of your analysis, which is the growth of organized business political involvement in the 1970s and the dramatic influence that had in sort of changing the game, to use a buzzword of the day, in Washington. Can you talk a little bit about what happened in the 1970s and what Americans should know about that?
Well, that's a great question, Bob, and I think it's one thing that readers of the book have found particularly interesting is that we argue that the 70s, which is in some ways sort of a forgotten decade in American politics, you know, people think of 1968 and Richard Nixon in Vietnam, and then they fast forward to Ronald Reagan and the 80s, and we say that actually a lot of the most important changes in American politics take place in the 1970s, and that they're driven by changes in the world of political organization as much as by election outcomes. Because in the early 1970s, even when Richard Nixon is in the White House, you get all sorts of liberal legislation. And Nixon actually, he was there when the Clean Air Act was passed, when much consumer protection legislation was passed. You had the biggest increases in social spending under any president when Richard Nixon was president. And then by the time Jimmy Carter is president, you're seeing, you would expect to see more liberal policies, but you actually get much more conservative policies. Many of the policies that we associate with Ronald Reagan, deregulation, cuts in capital gains taxes and other taxes on the well-to-do, these actually started in the late 1970s. So it raises the question, well, what happened that made Nixon an economic liberal and Carter in many ways, in practice, an economic conservative? And the answer that we give is that there was a dramatic shift in the organizational environment over this period, which mostly has to do with massive mobilization on the part of business. Business found itself losing a lot of major legislative battles in the late 1960s and early 1970s. This was the period when Ralph Nader was riding high, and there was a big expansion of the environmental movement and the consumer protection movement. And business mobilized to fight back. There's a famous memo by Lewis Powell, who at that point was working for the Chamber of Commerce and went on to be a Supreme Court justice, in which some people exaggerate the importance of the Powell memo. We don't actually think that it in itself was a catalyst, but it expressed very clearly the kind of thinking that was going on in business circles. And in this memo, he wrote that strength lies in organization, and through joint effort and in the political power available only through united action and national organizations. So he was basically saying we have to mobilize in a sustained way to start hammering away on legislators and politicians and regulators and shift the tide. And between the early 1970s and the late 1970s, there is a massive expansion of business organization. And we argue that by the late 1970s, they're really calling the shots in Washington.
Yeah, I reread the Powell memo after reading your book, and I was struck by, you know, how scared they were of Ralph Nader, what a large role he played in sort of freaking out business about politics.
Well, in some ways, I think it's understandable, because if you think about things like environmental regulation regulation of occupational conditions, safety conditions, consumer conditions. You know, we take many of these things for granted now, but they didn't exist until the late 1960s and early 1970s. Of course, one of the ironies, you know, business was used to not having to deal with those kinds of constraints. And one of the ironies of that movement towards greater regulation on behalf of citizens was that it brought business together. Because all of a sudden, rather than having, you know, some action in Washington that just affected one industry or one firm at a time, you had areas of regulation that were seen as a threat by many, many businesses at once. And they coalesced in opposition to those efforts. And then after a while, as we explained, they begin in the mid-1970s by playing defense and playing defense more effectively, and they block a lot of progressive legislation that's proposed after Carter becomes president, and it all gets killed in Congress, either filibustered or blocked before it even gets to that point. After they discover how successful they are on defense, they decide, well, now we can start playing offense. You know, now we can start pushing for changes that we would like to see. And so, for example, by the late 1970s, you get these these big tax cuts that are highly favorable to those at the top. And, of course, they're very familiar to us now. We've seen a lot of that kind of legislation over the last 30 years. But in the late 1970s, coming with a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president, that was a sea change.
Our guests, Pearson and Hacker, you just listened to Paul Pearson, authors of Winner Take All Politics. Let's go back to the phone lines again. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air.
Hi, I was listening to the discussion, and the idea of politics in the 70s came up. And I hadn't thought about this before, and it may have nothing whatsoever to do with what the topic is. But around that time, we did eliminate the military conscription, the military draft. And I have an intuition that there's somehow that plays into some of what we are seeing, but I really can't put it together. And if you tell me it has nothing to do with it, I'm fine with that too. But I just wondered what your guests might think about that, if there's any tie-in at all.
Well, thank you, Jacob Hacker. What role did eliminating the draft perhaps have on sort of the political sea change you describe in the book?
I don't think it had a big role in the 1970s. I mean, obviously it was a huge issue, but in the story we tell, it's really about the mobilization of corporate America for the first time on this broad scale that Paul was describing. I mean, the amount of money that corporations poured into politics, the amount of organization they did, the amount they put into think tanks and other groups that were trying to influence public debate and thinking about these issues was really had never been seen before in the United States. I do think that the end of the draft and more generally the waning of the kind of sense of shared fate that emerged during World War II does play a role in our story. It really contributed to a decline in the broad-based organizations that represented ordinary Americans on a wide range of issues, including pocketbook issues. And so we know the story of the decline of labor, and a lot of that decline had to do with the mobilization of business, the way in which business corporations fought updating of labor laws that would have helped unions organize in a new economic environment. You know, the most dramatic story of the 1970s is the fight over labor law reform in 1978, which featured what was then a very rare full-scale Senate filibuster against the law that business was fighting very aggressively and labor was supporting. And this law would have basically done some of the things that have been under debate in recent years unsuccessfully to try to make it easier for unions to organize, given corporate hostility to that organization. In any case, the law went down ultimately on because of this filibuster, and it was really the muscle flexing of business that brought that about. But there were other organizations besides labor that played a really important role in the mid-20th century, and Robert Putnam of Harvard and Theda Skocpol of Harvard have both written about this in different ways, and Putnam famously called these organizations and their work a sort of repository of social capital. And I think there's no question that the war and the widespread experience of it through the military draft really was an important part of undergirding that sense of shared fate that helped foster these large-scale organizations. But it is striking that over the 1970s and 80s, what we saw was essentially the decline, the ongoing decline of the kind of middle-class democracy that we had once seen, where there were lots of organizations that brought people of modest means into politics on a range of issues, including pocketbook issues, and their replacement by a different kind of liberalism and a different kind of politics, one that was dominated on the one side by business groups and conservative organizations, and on the other side by the kind of outgrowth of the environmental and consumer protection movements that Paul was just talking about, sort of new liberal groups, often funded by foundations that were not very focused on pocketbook issues. They had important causes they were fighting for, but one of them was not making sure that, you know, middle-class Americans had secure jobs with good pay. In fact, right now, if you look out at the landscape of organized groups fighting about politics, there really are very few groups whose primary concern is making sure that workers are treated fairly, that the rewards of economic growth are broadly distributed, that basic economic security is part and parcel of the American dream, and that's a change from 30 or 40 years ago. There was a much broader, much denser set of groups that were organized around these concerns. And
Professor
so that's the connection I would draw.
Let me just want to add on to that, Professor Hacker. I think you make a very strong case in the book that the decline of organized labor has been sort of the other side of the coin of the rise of organized business power over politics. And one thing I was wondering, I don't recall seeing it in the book very much, was the rise of sort of global labor arbitrage, which really started in the 60s for the first time in American history, and accelerated in the 70s and since then, where such a high percentage of fairly decent paying manufacturing jobs in particular that could be transported were shifted out of the country. And those were related to government policies as well. That wasn't some magical free market that made that possible. Was that a factor in all this, do you think?
Well, I'll jump in here.
Okay, please do.
So it clearly was a factor. And the decline in manufacturing in the United States was closely linked to the troubles that organized labor was facing. And I think it's fair to say that the free trade policies that were pursued in the United States were less protective of workers of the open border and free trade policies that were pursued in other advanced countries. But I don't think that is the crucial transformation that really explains why we have this really sharp rise at the very top. And for that, I think you have to understand and focus on the kind of policies that really promoted this highly financialized economy with very, very favorable laws, including tax laws and industrial relations laws, for corporations and for the very, very affluent. So these two things are occurring simultaneously, and the decline in manufacturing is clearly part of what is battering the middle class. But I could see, envision a transformation as it occurred in other countries where manufacturing became less prominent, but more high-skilled jobs and particularly high-skilled service jobs were replacing those manufacturing jobs, and policies were much more capable of moving people from one sector of the economy to the other than it was. As it was, I think very much it played out as a kind of implosion of the old economy with the replacement of a highly financialized, very unequal economy, and a lot of people left behind in the transformation.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest again, Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson, co-authors of Winner Take All Politics. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. We've got a little over 10 minutes left. We'll try to get our callers in. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, all professors. For the guests, have the ideas expressed by the novelist Ayn Rand, have they been a factor in getting the United States economy to where it is today?
I'll let you, Paul, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, I will take that. I guess I would say no, if you're talking about the historical story that we tell in the book, which is really about the last three decades. If you look at the contemporary discussion in Washington, I don't think there's any question that you hear Rand and her ideas that could probably be traceable to her, an even more radical version of free market ideology than the one that became common in Washington in the 80s and 90s, I think has really started to emerge in the last few years. But if you're looking, I think, at the more long-term stories, I mean, I guess you could draw connections, for example, that, you know, Alan Greenspan was an acolyte of Rand's, and, you know, some of that probably carried over into the way that he governed at the Fed. So there are some connections. But one of the interesting stories that we tell in the book is about the continued rightward movement of the Republican Party. It's not as if the Republican Party in 1980 was as deeply wedded to a sort of a purist free market view as the party that we have today. It's continued to become more and more conservative on economic issues. In almost every session, the legislature pushes the Republican Party further to the right. So I think Rand's thinking is influential within the Republican Party today. I think that would have been much less true 15 or 20 or 25 years ago.
You know, Paul Pearson, one of the really interesting discussions in Winner Take All Politics dealt with the transformation of the two parties and over the last 30 years. And one of the things that was striking to me is we hear the term polarization a lot. And the way it's used in conventional wisdom is that the moderates have left both parties And now both the Republicans are much further to the right and the Democrats are taken over by the wackies out on the left. And there's no middle ground for the great mass of rational, sane, you know, real Americans. And when I read your book, you sort of blew that up into little pieces.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. It certainly is an issue that we think is extremely important and is almost always misdescribed in the mainstream media. The parties are more divided, more separate from each other than they have been in 100 years. But we argue, especially on economic issues, that this is almost entirely due to the rightward movement of the Republican Party. And there's quite a bit of political science evidence using systematic study of roll call votes to support that view. The media doesn't like to portray things that way because it makes it seem like they're not being even-handed, and it's much easier for them to sort of take a position that says both parties are to blame and equally to blame. But we think it's much more accurate to describe the kind of movement that I just gave. And so and there are lots of pieces of evidence for that beyond the roll call voting. So, for example, on the Democratic side, for much of the period that we talk about, the Democratic Leadership Council, which was on economic issues moderate to almost conservative and very pro-business in its outlook, the Democratic Leadership Council was incredibly powerful in Democratic politics. Most of the party's presidential nominees came out of that wing of the party and were associated with the DLC. And you don't see anything like that on the Republican side. There is no organizational expression, certainly no powerful organizational expression of moderation on the Republican side during this period. There's just a steady march to the right. So we do think that looking at the political parties is a really important part of this story, and we devote a lot of attention to that. But the way that we would describe it is that the shift towards a winner-take-all economy and the shift of organizational power to the wealthy and to corporations has enabled the Republican Party to move rapidly to the right, and at the same time it has cross-pressured Democrats. It's made because they rely on many of those powerful groups and wealthy people for finance and organizational support, and so they find themselves cross-pressured on economic issues.
Let's go back
to the
phone.
I'm sorry. Polarized, but not polarized in a way that involves one party moving to the extreme right and the other one moving to the extreme left.
Let's go back to the phone lines for our last caller, line 4, Joplin, Missouri. You're on the air with Hacker and Pearson.
Hi. I was wondering how much you think campaign financing and the way that political campaigns cost so much money has affected the winner-take-all type of mentality, because it seems like the role of lobbying and how much money that politicians have to raise for their elections has really determined a lot of legislation that gets written, because the lobbyists then can exert much more influence than an average American on the political system.
Thank you very much, caller. And Jacob Hacker, as you answer that, you allude to this at the end of the book, Citizens United court decision came down just as I think you were putting the finishing touches on the manuscript. You know, how that might have changed your analysis or changes the analysis of the role of finance.
Well, I'll just say that when Citizens United came down right before we were done, we couldn't think of a stronger kind of symbolic statement of the problem that we saw in our democracy, in the sense that it was basically ratifying the view that corporations should be treated just as people in our democracy. And, you know, our democracy did not say all men and our Declaration of Independence didn't say all men and corporations are created equal. How big the effect of Citizens United will be, given how weak the campaign finance system regime was already, is an open question. But I think it was a very strong statement from a court that's been very business friendly on that there was really no restrictions on the unlimited funds that corporations pour into politics. I thought that the caller really hit the nail on the head by mentioning both campaign finance and lobbying. That's the sort of twin assault that comes from corporate quarters that really drives politics. It's not just the money that's spent on campaigns, which comes from often from a lot of sources, but it's also just the huge sums that corporations are putting into lobbying. And the numbers are so staggering that people don't, you know, often are just disbelieving. We've seen corporate lobbying dollars go from, you know, 0.4 of a billion in the early 1980s to about $4 billion in 2007. And those numbers are vastly, those are the official numbers, they vastly understate, I think, what's really spent. We're talking about 15,000 lobbyists in Washington. And those lobbyists are overwhelmingly working on behalf of the beneficiaries of the winner-take-all economy. And so that's the challenge we face. It's really how to create the kind of organized counterweight to the very concentrated economic might that we're seeing exercised through campaign finance and lobbying. And, you know, what we hoped to do with winner-take-all politics was to make people sort of step back and ask, is this really inevitable to have a society, an economy, a democracy that's so tilted in ways that are just apparent, I think, increasingly to Americans? And if it's not, what's it going to take to bring about change? And we do see some cause for hope. It's hard, I think, right now, looking at, you know, how distorted our democracy and dysfunctional our democracy seems, to feel hopeful. But the hope, I think, comes from looking at the past and seeing that in the past there has been periods in which we've seen this kind of hyper-concentration and distortion of democracy before, and there's been effective political reforms and effective political movements that's pushed back. And we hope that we can play some small, you know, part in provoking that kind of discussion and maybe that kind of action.
You know, Professor Pearson, along these lines, your book accompanies sort of the worst economic situation we've had in the United States since the 1930s. And at this particular moment, it looks indeed like the 1930s, in which we're in for a long haul of stagnation and declining incomes and cuts in social services. And one of the things that's striking about the research you've done is the parallels between economic inequality in the 1920s and its growth in that era to the era leading up to this, what's called the Great Recession. And I saw recently a survey of economists who are by no means traditionally a liberal group at this point in time, and 65% of them said the major reason why businesses aren't investing is there's not enough demand. Consumers don't have money to buy things, which seems to go directly out of your argument. I mean, there are real economic consequences to inequality, aren't there?
Oh, there are huge consequences. I mean, I think, you know, many economists have tried to track the ways in which rising inequality contributed to financial speculation, the bubble economy, and the events that began in 2007 and 2008. But I think today we're witnessing another piece of it, which you're alluding to, which is, to me, there is no to me, and I think to most Americans, there is no question that the biggest issue confronting the United States is unemployment, that we have huge human resources lying idle, at a time when it would actually be very cheap in terms of borrowing to put these people to work doing constructive things for American society and for the American economy. And yet the chance of that happening in Washington today is zero, which says something about the extent to which Washington has been captured. And, you know, one thing that I think we haven't emphasized enough today is that much of the capture takes the form of just tying Washington up in knots, gridlock, filibusters, so that it cannot respond in a constructive way to the changes, the dynamism that's inevitable in a market economy.
Professor Pearson, so, Professor Hacker, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio for the next show. Both of you gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for writing one of the most important books I've read in years and for the work you do.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us on.
I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Kyle Kroha, my engineer, my producer, Melissa Trentz. And next week, I'll be back 167 hours now with Ellie Pariser talking about the filter bubble and his argument about what's going on with the Internet and the digital future. I'm Bob McChesney, everyone. Have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
High pressure should make it pleasant with comfortable temperatures and humidity levels for the next several days, then a chance of rain again on Wednesday. Mostly sunny is our forecast for today, with a high of 80. Mostly clear, a low of 55 tonight, and then tomorrow and Tuesday, sunny with a high of 82. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3.